Now I would like to introduce Darren Anderson from the Weitzman Institute, and he's going to be speaking on transforming care for LGBT people with collaborative learning and telementoring.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for being here and listening to this talk. And I am going to talk a little bit about Project ECHO, but you've heard such glowing praise for it and clear descriptions about what ECHO is. I'm actually going to talk a little bit about some additional elements that we've been introducing to go along with ECHO to try to augment the process of learning. So just, I'm a primary care provider by training. I've worked in FQHCs for my entire career with a brief stint in the VA. And I work at a company called the Community Health Center, Inc. We're one of the largest FQHCs in the country. We're in Connecticut, and we deliver care across about 200 different locations in the state. For about 140,000 patients, and we created something called the Weitzman Institute about 8 years ago, which is part of CHC, but it's an innovation and research center that really places its entire focus on research and innovations and ways of transforming primary care. And so I was actually sitting on my couch in 2011 and reading my copy of the New England Journal, and the lead article that I was reading was written by Dr. Arora, and it's the article that you showed. And I don't think I'm exaggerating to say as I read it, I said something along the lines of, Eureka, this is exactly what we need. And I did fly out to New Mexico, I think just a month later, met Dr. Arora and the whole team, and they, as they continued to do graciously, shared all of their material, encouraged us to replicate. And as a result of that generosity and their incredible expertise, they have led the replication of ECHO across the world and across the country. And so we came back and endeavored to send up what I think still is the only FQHC-run Project ECHO. And we run it very similarly to the way you've already heard, so I won't go into detail. There's a combination of case presentations and didactics. One of the things that's slightly different is we've invited our FQHC colleagues and friends from around the country to participate. Many places, including us, don't have a friendly neighborhood academic health center that's producing a Project ECHO are willing to do so. And so we have people joining us from Montana, we have people joining us from Northern California, and 23 other states around the country that take part in one or another of our Project ECHOs. And our most heavily subscribed is the one focused on chronic pain, with buprenorphine and opioid addiction being a close second. So how does that take us to this topic, and why am I here at an STD conference? And I'll admit this is my first ever STD conference, and I'll try to explain sort of how that came about. Well, it came about because a group of very talented, very smart, and very passionate people came together to try to figure out how to tackle a problem in a new and different way. And I've spent a lot of my career and time thinking about operationalization. I'm always struck when I talk to specialists, some of my friends who've gone into specialty care and subspecialty care, the kind of people who write guidelines and really know exactly how things ought to be done. I'm always struck by how surprised they are that all that they know and all that is known doesn't end up happening on the front lines. There's this massive gap between what we know we ought to be doing and what actually happens. And as I say a lot of times to them and others and anyone willing to listen, it's not because we're stupid. It's not because primary care providers, nurse practitioners, PAs don't know the guidelines. But I was struck, and I think this quote, which I'm going to read, really gets to the heart of what we often forget when we think about guidelines. We regularly engage in vigorous conversations about clinical evidence with our colleagues, but we seldom enter into those conversations with the clear understanding that any conclusions we reach will be translated or need to be translated into a system of standing orders, reminders, measurements, feedback loops, and other steps to implement any consensus that emerges. And in all of that text is the key to why things don't always happen as easily as they should, and why when you go to the front lines in a primary care center, even a really good one, you'll find maybe 50% of the people over 50 getting colon cancer screening. You'll find STDs not necessarily being screened for appropriately, and a whole number of other things that I could, as the quality director, I could go on and talk about. So I was walking down the street talking to a friend of mine at NAC, Kathy McNamara is her name, and she was telling me about somebody named Dan Lentini, who was very committed to figuring out new ways, and he happens to be sitting right here, so I'm going to introduce him and make fun of him, not going to make fun of him, but definitely call him out. And he was intrigued and perplexed by the challenge of how to address the issue of STDs and MSM. increasing rates of gonorrhea and chlamydia. And he and Kathy, I think, together came up with the idea that FQHCs, you know, large network taking care of millions of people around the country, many of them underserved from cities and rural locations around the country, might hold the key to how we could address this issue. So our conversation started with things like, well, we could do webinars, we could engage them with public health offices, we could do this, we could do that, maybe we could publish some guidelines, something like that. But as we started talking about it, I said, you know, I think that quote that I just mentioned contains the key to what needs to be done. We don't need to bequeath more knowledge. We actually need to help FQHCs embrace and transform systems. That's where Project ECHO comes in, because what is a tool to get knowledge out there and to engage people at the front lines in the process of transforming the way they do things and not just lecturing at them? And I'm glad that it's already been really highlighted how much Project ECHO is not a webinar. It's not a lecture. It's an active engagement of people collaborating to learn. And so long and the short of this story is that we came up with the idea to create a new Project ECHO that would focus on LGBT care, that would, in so doing, teach FQHCs around the country how to become LGBT welcoming, how to treat, how to identify and screen, ask questions about sexual orientation and gender identity, take a good sexual history, screen appropriately, and when STDs were identified, treat them appropriately. And that's a complicated endeavor because, as we've come to find out, we're not doing this now at all. So the end result of all of that, after many months of planning and lots of participation from people around the country, including Bruce Furness, who is also here from the CDC and from Washington, and our colleagues at Fenway, we created a brand new ECHO called Project ECHO LGBT. And the way our ECHO is run, as an FQHC in Connecticut, we don't have all of the specialists in our own network, and so many of our ECHOs, including this one, feature people all over the place. So this is the Fenway Institute in Boston, and they form our expert faculty team, and they broadcast from Boston. Our ECHO coordination team, the technology people that you mentioned, the backbone of the system, they do the solicitation of cases. They make sure everyone connects and people are using the technology correctly. They maintain the schedule and they make sure everything runs on time. They're located in Middletown, and the participants are all over the country. They're from Los Angeles to Boston and everywhere in between. And they join, they present their cases, they listen to a brief didactic, and they learn about LGBT care. A lot of questions about trans care, very growing hot issue in FQHCs, but they learn how to provide good care. And they learn through case-based learning. They talk back and forth, they share ideas, and gradually get smarter and better in what they do. But that's not the end of the story. And so where this story is kind of takes a slight right turn is what we came to realize, but really before setting this up, is if you have a Project ECHO and you bring your clinicians on and you let them present cases, you get clinicians that are very well trained about in something that they might otherwise not know how to do. But as I was kind of alluding to before, the system piece has been ignored. So you can end up with a very well-trained clinician working in a system that still doesn't serve. So I got an email from one of our most senior clinicians. He works in our New London office. Got it last week. And he said, thank you so much for this program. Now I know why my such and such patient, 23-year-old male patient, always looked down and seemed a little uncomfortable when I was talking with him and seeing with him. I never realized that he was trans. And so what had happened in the interim was our clinic had taken part, in addition to Project ECHO, in a second component of this, which is a learning collaborative, where they were learning some of the real nuts and bolts. How do you appropriately ask sexual orientation and gender identity? Because it turned out we had no idea. The first part of this project was, well, how many LGBT people do you have in your clinic? Nobody knew because nobody was asking. And that sounds obvious, but it's really hard. Who asks? How do you ask? What questions do you use? Where do you record the information? Where do you record it so that the clinician is made aware of that, and who's the right person to do it? So while our clinicians were taking part in Project ECHO, their team, which includes a medical assistant, a nurse, a counselor, a behavioral health provider, were engaging in a learning collaborative. And that's what's unique about this program is we have combined an IHI-style, Institute for Healthcare Improvement-style breakthrough series collaborative, which is a very structured learning collaborative module, and run it in parallel with Project ECHO. So while the clinicians are learning LGBT care on ECHO, they and their team are also participating in a learning collaborative, which is metrics-driven. And the learning collaboratives have learning sessions, They have an online learning management system where they can watch videos and post questions and have discussions. And they have a very defined set of measures that they need to collect and report on every month and do PDSA cycles aimed at trying to at implementing systems to improve the outcomes that they're studying. And I'll show you what those outcomes are. This is our logic model. And the logic model, without going through all of it, is that ECHO plus a practice improvement collaborative will lead to a variety of activities and outputs that ultimately will embed best practices within FQHCs that will then be better empowered to identify LGBT people, to implement appropriate screening, and to treat appropriately, and ultimately lead to improvement in the original problem that brought us to this, which was increasing rates of STDs in MSM people. So these are the measures, and I won't go through them in gory detail. We had a half an hour presentation that Bruce and I gave to really argue and discuss each of these measures. But every participant in Project ECHO, in this collaborative, needs to report every month on these numbers. And the first one was not syphilis screening rates or HIV. It was the number of patients that were seen in the past month who had SOGI questions asked and documented in the EHR. Because if you can't identify, if you don't know, how can we do anything further? And the second core measure was, of those patients, how many of them had an appropriate sexual history documented in the electronic health record? Once you have asked SOGI questions and learned and documented appropriately a sexual history, then we can start making some progress on the actual healthcare issue at hand. And then the next measures, as you can see, are, this is the one for syphilis screening, this is chlamydia and gonorrhea screening rates, and this is HIV screening rates. But if you sort of follow the progression, this is what it actually looks like in real time. So what I can't present to you today is the final results showing that we've solved all the world's problems, because this is ongoing. We just started back in the spring. We're about halfway through. But this is our first cut of data, and it shows exactly what I thought it would show, which is that starting at the beginning, if you read across the top line, the number of patients who had a visit who had documented SOGI questions in the record was 5.2%. So, like I said, we didn't know. None of our clinics had any solid mechanism for collecting that information. And after only a couple of months, this was the hardest thing we did. That number has gone up to 11%, and it's going to go up much more rapidly as our sites come online and really learn how to do this and implement it and operationalize it in clinic practice. You can see that of those patients in the denominator, that sexual history, appropriate documentation of sexual history has gone up to 51%. And you can see that our LGBT screening rates have not started to move yet. And that's because we've identified so few. But this is what we're going to be tracking and going forward. We really introduced these in phases. We started focusing entirely on SOGI. Now we're focusing a lot on sexual health screening. And going forward, we're going to really turn our focus to screening rates themselves. So I wanted to show you how we're approaching the evaluation of this, because one of the fascinating things about ECHO is not that much is known or has been studied about sort of, well, if this works and how it works and why it works. The paper in the New England Journal that Bruce referred to is a beautiful cluster randomized trial that shows the potential for ECHO to improve outcomes when treated in primary care. And really, this is the impact model underlying exactly what we think ECHO and the collaborative does, that by increasing knowledge and engaging teams to change practice, you can obtain improved patient outcomes. And I want to show you, this is a parallel example of how we've looked at this and how a similar problem in primary care, which is that of chronic pain. This has nothing to do with LGBT, but we're hoping to see numbers just like this with the LGBT collaborative. These are two collaboratives that ran one after the other, where primary care providers were assessed for their knowledge about pain. We used a validated tool that demonstrated how much they knew about pain management, and you can see in both of these cases there were significant increases in their knowledge after taking part. That knowledge translated into some real activities. Prior to the intervention, only 14% were taking a pain functional assessment. We're making a pain functional assessment, whereas 60% were doing so afterwards, one of the core foundations of good pain care. Documenting pain and reassessing it went up, and referrals to behavioral health for interdisciplinary care for pain went up as well, and opioid prescribing went down. We also asked those that were participating in the Learning Collaborative, we'd have them track measures. One of their key measures was whether or not patients who had chronic pain were being identified and referred to behavioral health and or to substance abuse, and we saw over the course of the collaborative that those numbers went up substantially. And these are numbers, I won't go into this in too much detail, showing that opioid prescribing in the intervention group went down. And I'm showing this not to, because this isn't a pain conference and probably don't care too much about opioid prescribing per se, but to show you more how we approach, and in hopefully in 6 months we'll have a table just like this that shows things related to STD and LGBT care. And so, you know, with that, I think I was thinking about Johannes Gutenberg and how Europe progressed from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance to the Enlightenment. And, you know, prior to Gutenberg, knowledge was cloistered in cloisters. It was cloistered in monasteries, and it was, if at all, bequeathed to the people through the voice of a priest or somebody like that. And then I was thinking about Sanjeev Arora, who is our modern version of Gutenberg, who said, no, we need to make this knowledge available to the people. And it was the printing press and the movable text of the printing press that allowed that to happen. And the entire world changed as a result of that. And I don't think I'm grandiose in thinking this is exactly the way this is going to happen, because we in primary care need access to that knowledge in ways that don't require patients to travel 100 miles, 200 miles to see a specialist and wait 6 months to get in to see and then hope that we get a fax note back telling us what to do. That hasn't served us anymore. And so this is our way of democratizing knowledge, spreading it across the country and helping us to do a better job and take all of those guidelines and knowledge that we have and making sure it gets out to the front lines where it's needed. So with that, I have a lot of acknowledgments. Wanda Montalvo is our project PI for this, and she is back in Connecticut dealing with some personnel issues that we're having at the Weizmann Institute and has been driving this process forward on a national scale, working with all of our frontline teams to help them through this challenging process. Hagi Erickson leads our Project ECHO, and I've already mentioned Dan and Bruce from the CDC, and Kathy McNamara as well from NAC are the team of people who come together and talk every 2 weeks and try to figure out how to do this. So with that, I'll end, and be glad to take any questions. Thank you.
Thanks. If people have any questions, please come up to the mic and introduce yourselves. While we're waiting for people to come up, I have a question.
Sure.
You know, we in our community have many FQHCs, I'm sure as many other communities do. How can we work with our communities to help them get engaged with your ECHO Clinic project?
You know, we've, and I know Sanjeev and Bruce would say the same thing. I think, you know, there are ECHO replication sites all over the country, and many of them open for business, if you will. And, you know, ours, we've made ours available to clinics across the country. Usually it happens with an email, and the email is followed by a Zoom link, and we can have an FQHC or a provider in another setting joining ECHO literally within 2 weeks. And a brief story to demonstrate that. I don't know if any of you remember, there was a lot of publicity about a year ago or so, maybe more, about an HIV outbreak in the middle of rural Indiana. And there was a family doctor who I read in the paper was like right in the middle of this little town where all of these cases were popping up. And he was saying things like, oh, my God, what do I do? We called him and said, you know, we have an HIV ECHO. Would you like to join? 2 weeks later, he was on, and he's been joining ever since and treating those patients for HIV by joining ECHO. So kind of getting to the question that was asked before, I think this is a scalable intervention. We've pushed it up as high as 50. I kind of agree with the numbers you were saying. Yes, you can take 200, but it's not very participatory when it's 200. We managed with 50. It gets a little big, and usually when we get above 50, we add another one. So we now have two pain echoes that run on alternating Thursdays. One of them we call West Coast Echo, one is East Coast Echo. But we're committed to making it available to as many people as possible. So short answer is give us an email or a call, or give Bruce a call.
Thanks.
Hi, Rob Brawley from Kentucky again.
Yeah.
What is the cost of starting up a project like this? We've tried a couple times to write grants for replicating an ECHO project, and no coins have come to Kentucky for doing that. So is it possible just to sort of divert our existing telemedicine resources at our large medical schools and create this with a lot less cost?
Yeah, that's a good question. We spend an enormous amount of time thinking about that because, you know, we're kind of the little guys in this. We're an FQHC. We don't have access. We haven't been able to pull down big grants from Robert Wood Johnson or sites like that. So we spent a lot of time thinking about how to be flexible and nimble and get funding to do this. So the cost, I think, you know, the Zoom is very cheap. I don't mean Zoom, a couple hundred dollars. Zoom is very, the actual technology is the easy part. I think the actual cost are the people behind it who run it, who, like the Augie Erickson's that I mentioned, and Kelly and Lauren are here actually from the Weitzman as well, who also help support some elements of Project Echo. So it's the people behind it that actually do the work and the scheduling and the getting you set up, and then it's your specialists. So I think, you know, we contract with our specialists and we have to pay them. So we've gotten funding from every possible source we can think of. We've gotten small grants. We got one grant from Colorado, from the Department of Health to produce an echo, a pain echo for them. A group called Maine Quality Counts contracted with us. So we publicize what we do. We look for every possible funding opportunity that we can grab. And I think we did a calculation, and I won't quote a number, but I think we estimated somewhere in the range of $200,000 to $300,000 to start a brand new echo from scratch and get it off the ground. And that's about what this one cost, the LGBT echo, I think. And then sustaining it, you know, it's mainly the faculty time and the one or two people that are running it. So it's a difficult question to answer, but being nimble and flexible and you're just getting out there. And a lot of people don't fund this, it's true. We've tried to tie it with research grants, and we have a PCORI that we submitted that almost got funded, really, really looking to not just deliver Project Echo, but study and understand it. And we've gotten several research grants that have been funded that provide some money to keep it going, but more money to study it and evaluate it. The people who don't pay for it are the payers, because none of us have yet been able to demonstrate a strong ROI. And when I go to talk to Anthem or when I go to talk to Connecticut Medicaid, that's what they want to know. How much money does it save? I think we all believe that it does, and I think we'll get at that someday, but we haven't yet been able to prove that. And until we can, the payers are not going to talk about this as much as we would like them to.
And I'll just add two really quick things. We are starting a new task, but in this sense, it's telemedicine for our antimicrobial stewardship program. So it's different. Again, we've adapted the model, and right now our budget for the first year, which is a pilot year, is $160,000. That does include some of our time, but our budget for our Part B work is $75,000 a year, so not a lot, and our time is sort of included in that. And then what's been helpful for us in Washington expanding our ECHO projects is the Department of Health. So the Department of Health has approached us to basically work on specific issues. So we were given money this year to build a PrEP echo. So that is a part of our HIV echo, but we always include PrEP information, and they've been great. So they've had like pockets of money that they've been able to give us with really without a lot of work up front. So that's just been great. So they will specifically, you know, target PrEP or some other issue, and we've rolled that into that grant. So that's worked for us.
I might just add, I mean, I think a lot of different states have taken different approaches. The state of New Mexico gives the University of New Mexico $2 million a year to support those 20 projects that are serving people in the state of New Mexico. So our TB Echo is a collaboration between the Department of Health. They provide their time, their expertise. That's what they bring to the table. We provide the IT and admin part of it. We looked at that as being supported through this legislative grant to us that we get on an annual basis. I know that Missouri has worked out through their legislature supporting the University of Missouri. So there are a number of states that have started going to their legislatures to get support and then collaborating with their state health departments.
Any other questions for any of the panelists? Sure.
I was wanting to ask the audience, what do you, having heard about these different implementation, different models of implementing ECHO in around STD issues, what do you all think the STD community needs in terms of, and whether this model might help serve your needs, and what might that look like? How would you, if you were creating some sort of STD ECHO program or other use of these innovative technologies, how would you want to use them? Anyone with ideas? Mary Cam, what are you thinking?
Sorry, but you know, I'm the global person, so I've talked with you about ideas globally, but the thing that comes to mind out of this conferences, you know, the great clinical things that you already have examples of, but also some of the kind of bread and butter public health strategies that are going away, like partner notification and partner services. Like, this is something that in a lot of states and communities is an issue that I know we talk about a lot at the national level, like how to help local programs focus and figure out best use of resources that are becoming increasingly scarce. So that's one thing that comes to mind.
I'm Maureen Scahill from Rochester, New York, the university there. We also have considered that for our STD ECHO is some of that sort of infrastructure systems stuff, including laboratory issues. And so that while we want to try and make it as much like the traditional ECHO where it's case-based, we know that there are other pieces. And when I was at the ECHO training last month, I learned from this Bruce about this talk and what the University of Washington was doing. And this is, you know, really very helpful, that sort of infrastructure, you know, what you just said. I just want to say I think that's really a great idea and something that this kind of method could reach. And when we do our work with our state health department grant, and the Project ECHO is going to follow the same pattern, is that we have every single county health department involved in it with us. And in New York State, I think that's like 35 counties or something like that. And so that will be part of it, but it is not just we anticipate having one next year about some lab issues, and our warm line gets a lot of calls from DIS, and so that's another thing we want to work on.
Standing Melanie Taylor, I work for IHS in Phoenix. Good to see you. Thanks for putting up the Navajo protocol. I want to say that there are certain things about STDs that are very rare that clinicians are not accustomed to seeing, and mainly those are related to syphilis, particularly congenital syphilis. There's a lot of problems and challenges with case management of both the mother before she delivers and then the infant. And there are not a lot of resources for public health departments, not a lot of clinicians that are available for referrals or even consultation. And so that, plus the new ocular syphilis issues that have come up recently, would be tremendous to have something, or at least the resource of using ECHO to bring together case presentations for those. So I think there are a lot of opportunities within the U.S. to use ECHO for STD. So good to see you. Thanks.
Hi. Harlan Roplat, Los Angeles County Department of Public Health. I didn't hear all the presentations together, but I heard quite a bit. And the thing that comes to, I'm not a clinician, and my clinical colleagues, I would let them weigh in on the clinical applications. The thing that leaps out to me as possible application or desirable application for us are training opportunities that are not necessarily clinical-based. So again, not the case-based thing so much as opportunities to bring people together with common questions. The we are implementing a comprehensive sexual health education law in California. The desire of educators, schools, and teachers to have practice and answer questions and know how to do different parts of the curriculum is huge. This kind of model would be great for that. There are clinical issues and systems billing things, reporting issues. They're not. The thing that leaps to my mind of the applications that I work with, it's not so much a case-based thing as it would be an opportunity for ongoing learning systems. So, but I think it has huge applications for that. And one other thing I would say is the thing that the program started with was basic telemedicine, where it's like a patient has a question. I've been trying to think of applications for us. You know, we, for a long time, we've had like the STD hotline, which is like a toll-free number that, you know, people will call up and they ask questions about STDs for the public. And the use of that hotline has gone down quite a bit, I think, because people get their information online in other ways. But we've been talking about what are other ways that we could serve that need, chat, or, you know, I don't know, if having a video conferencing where people could hear their questions answered public would be great, too.
I'll just say two things. I really echo, your piece, because the only time for our ECHO that we actually did case presentations was on ocular syphilis. that was laying the groundwork, right, of what's going on in the U.S. And then as we engaged our audience more and more, it became obvious that they wanted to talk about clinic infrastructure. That is where their backs are broken and they need help. It really wasn't a training piece as much. It was, how do we operationalize lab tests? How do we change this? And it's interesting because each site has its own unique issues. There could be just like an admin person in a clinic who's not on board with these changes and working with that person who's not a clinician. And then in another case, it's the revolving door of clinicians who keep leaving. So that's really why our model adapted, because it was what our target audience wanted and needed.
Any other questions?
Just curious, as a gray hair who likes computers, I just wonder, is there a years since training adaptation to this, where newer trainees really like it, trainees that have been out for 20, 30 years are struggling to put it all together?
I would say no. Yeah, I'm going to say no. We have a large number of clinicians from all over the country, and they range in age and experience. I think it's a place to revitalize.
Yes,
The purpose of ECHO is to train you and sustain you to do things that you otherwise wouldn't feel comfortable doing. And so, you know, I consider myself on the older side of the clinicians. That to me is incredibly appealing now at this stage in my career. And maybe even more so than it is fresh out of training. So I think it actually serves both purposes well.
So I'll say two things really quickly. One is our faculty at UW love this, and even when we no longer had budget support for them, they came anyway because it meant so much to them. They're teachers by nature, and they liked connecting to people who were thirsty for knowledge and sharing. The other thing on our rural HIV ECHO, what we've seen with younger providers in particular, they are isolated in the field. Like in Montana, Wyoming, they are isolated. They come from a med school setting where they have a huge amount of infrastructure and support, but now they're out in Montana and they don't. So this is a way for them to connect with other providers and really enhance and grow their career. And this goes to the heart of workforce development, which is an issue we struggle with all the time.
And I also want to add, I mean, I've been surprised at how many people in their 50s, 60s, 70s participate, and they may need some of them a little help. Many people in that age group, though, are better than some of the younger people. So I adapting and catching on, if they want to figure out how to work their laptop, they are amazingly resourceful. But we also work with people one-on-one to get them online. But I also want to say, just in terms of harnessing the knowledge and experience of older clinicians, many of whom have retired, this is actually one opportunity to allow them to continue to participate and to bring their expertise. And they could be at home, or they can come into the university or wherever, or they could be, you know, at their summer house if they're lucky, and actually be able to continue to participate and keep learning, but also to add their knowledge and their incredible knowledge. And I know that as STD departments are getting smaller, it's true for TB programs as well, that expertise that's developed over the last 20, 30 years, many of the people with that expertise are retiring, and it's sad that that just goes away. So, you know, I really hope that this platform can be used to help keep many of those clinicians engaged and public health practitioners to actually keep participating and sharing that knowledge. I think it's a fabulous opportunity for that to keep them, you know, their resource to contribute as long as they're able and willing.
Well, it's 4:15, so let's give a hand to our panelists for this great session, and hopefully you can stick around.